Good morning. Our learning today is sponsored by Alex and Valerie Olson with Zchut Svagana Yisrael, and in memory of Hindeleah Bat Avram Alei Shalom, and also Refuah Shleima for Malka Freidel Bat Miriam Lieber. There should be Refuah Shleima, and the Sham should have an Aliyah, and Tzahal should have success. Also sponsored this morning by Harvey and Lola Rosenblum in memory of Lola's father, Meir Hirsch, Meir Ben Reb Moshe, Alav Shalom, the Shamot should have Aliyot. A learning will be in their memory. May their memory continue to be a blessing. We are on Yud Gimel Amud Bet at the very bottom. I've given you out Yud Dalet. So I'll read out for you outside at the bottom of Yud Gimel as we head into Yud Dalet. There is a number of details that will come up on this stuff. There's essentially one theme. We're going to talk about what prophecy means at some great length, but through the lens of the idea that it's quite subtle in the Megillah. There's no overt moment when somebody comes on the scene and says, I've heard from God the following in the name of God. You don't get that kind of overt prophecy. And Chazal will reflect on what the purpose of prophecy is. If I were to tell you, give me a synonym for prophecy, would you have one?
Insight?
Anybody else? What is the prophet's job? To do what?
Warn the people.
Warn the people, predict. Excellent. Okay, so we're going to examine some of these terms. And there's going to be one quote from the Megillah right toward the beginning when the king removes the ring and gives it to Haman. And the Gemara is going to observe that that single moment, just the removal of the ring, which is a performative political gesture, was more effective than all the prophets in Israel. And that might be a rhetorical turn. There have been many rabbis who have observed that it takes a huge amount of work for prophets to have an impact. I think Rabbi Sacks would sometimes remark that Jonah was the most successful prophet, despite the fact we've got books and books and reams of pages of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel trying to convince the Jews of what's coming. They don't listen. Jonah comes to Nineveh and says, 40 days or there'll be trouble, and they all repent. So we're not a very receptive people when it comes to prophetic warnings. But here they're going to sit in that single moment, just giving the ring to Haman, put everybody into a mode of panic. Whereas the prophet's standing there for days saying, you know, woe is you, the end is nigh. Probably not. Which suggests that Chazal see politics as an important realm of life, that a tiny move, you know, giving power to one civil servant can change the fate and the destiny of a nation. That in some ways can be an effective means of being reflective instead of just religious voices. So that's where we'll head. And then we'll have a number of reflections on how many prophets were there, who were the prophets, were there female prophets?
Yes.
How many?
Seven.
We're going to go through the seven. How do we know there were prophets? We're going to have proofs for each of them being prophetic. And we'll end up with Esther at the end of the list. And then we'll come back to Huldah, who many may not know that much about. We'll come back to her. But in the meantime, we've got a couple of observations towards Haman's character. So at the bottom of Yud Gimel on the bed, I know you don't have it. Some of you all say it out loud. The previous stuff, we have again been going through the beginning of the second parak of the Megillah now, not of Masechet Megillah, but of the Megillah itself. We've already established the first chapter was devoted to painting a picture of revelry and party. Not that Jews were drunkards. The Persians and the Medians were drunkards. But the Jews participated not because they were enthralled by materialism. The crime, so to speak, was that they were ready to give up on their national hopes. They were ready to give up on the Jewish dream that Zion would be at the center of their lives. The 70 years had passed. Obviously, we're not going back. We're just going to settle here. And that complicity with the Kohanim's vestments being paraded, with the Kalim of the Mikdash being paraded, with the sense that, you know, it's over. We've got nothing to hold on to anymore, led to a looming cloud that sat over the Jewish people as they then watched everything fall apart. When they realized, you know, it describes the party, one day is Shabbos and they're drinking, and the Jews start their Shabbos meal with drink, but also with Divrei Torah. And then they see everyone around them has fallen into patterns of lust and depravity, trying to get naked women to come, and they think, oh my gosh, this is dreadful. And then Vashti refuses, and Ahasuerus says to the rabbis, so no, what should I do? She won't come and dance naked before everybody. They think, oh my gosh, we've been put in a horrific position. If we say that she should die in the morning, the king will sober up and blame us. And if we say, oh, it's fine, leave it, it sounds like we don't care about the standing of the king. So the rabbis demur, and they just say, look, it's we don't have a land. We're unrooted right now, and in a state of suspension like this, we can't think clearly about matters of life and death. So you're going to have to go and speak to somebody else. Speak to the Ammonites or the Moabites who have been on their land for centuries, which is a profound observation about the mental state of refugees, of people on the run who don't have a firm place to live, which Chazal seemed to indicate we were from the time of the destruction and exile in the first case, and then presumably in the second case too. Okay, so we've established the pattern of the party. We then established Mordechai's power. His names indicate that he turned the people to prayer. We looked at Esther's name, indicating that she was righteous, but also oddly unappealing from an objective perspective. And God did all sorts of subtle maneuvers to make sure that she would be appealing to the king, including the time of year this happened, so he would naturally be cold and be affected by body warmth, that she was made more attractive than she would have been naturally, physically and sensually. And then we head into Haman's character, who jumps on the scene when the rabbis refuse to get involved. And this is where we're up to. So at the bottom, about four-fifths of the way down, you'd give Malamud Bet. First one, then, is in our Gef. We quote, Haman was so angry he wanted to cast his hand against Mordechai Levado, just Mordechai he wanted to kill, which indicates a very specific agitation. Mordechai's got this personal animus towards Mordechai, and it then bloats into a genocidal wish to kill all Jews, which is a Chazal Amarav, or Azeb, kill Mordechai Levado. Originally, he just wanted to get rid of Mordechai. Levasof ba'am Mordechai. Then he wanted to get rid of the people of Mordechai, Umanu, and who are the people of Mordechai? The Rabbanah. He wanted to get rid of Mordechai, and they said, you know what? Mordechai is not the problem. It's his whole ilk. And who are his ilk? Oh, it's the rabbis. And then, Levasof, Bechol HaYudim. And he says, you know what? The rabbis is representative of this larger people. We need to get rid of everybody. And it is this unstable sense that a personal animus, unchecked, can swell into irrational wishes of destruction. And that can go in any direction. And here the warning is that this was Haman's character. He was just an overflowing bulb of rage that even letting out a small, I'm for some reason thinking about X-Men, and I can't remember the name of the guy with it. Is it Cyclops? Cyclops, the guy who has to wear this thing over his eyes to make sure it's a fine line. If he takes it off, it just destroys everything, which is obviously based on the story of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, that some of you may be familiar with, who hides in the cave, Shabbos Daf Lamed, who comes out, and everywhere he looks, everything is getting incinerated. So we have to go back to the cave so he can control his vision so he doesn't end up incinerating everybody. That's what happens to anger in this context. Hipil Purhu Agoral. So he then set a lottery, and when did it fall out? Wonderful, it fell on Adar, Tana, and it was told, Kim Shinafel Pu B'chodesh Adar Sameh Simcha Gadola, and Haman was overjoyed it fell in Adar, because what happens in Adar? This is a bad time for the Jews. What happened in Adar? Purim hadn't happened yet. So what's the only thing that happened on the record? Somebody great died away. Moshe died. Amar Nafali Pur B'yerach Shemek Bo Moshe. This is a month where Moshe died. Oh, I'm going to get them. What did he forget, though? It was also the month Moshe was born. And he didn't know Shabbashiva Ba'adar made Shabbashiva Adar Nola. He didn't know that the day Moshe died was also the day he born. So it was a promise of hope. That was his mistake. Yeshno Emachat. And then Haman walks into Ahasuerus and he says, you know what, king? There is this people. They're a small people, but they're scattered all over the kingdom. They've got their own rules, their own laws. They don't pay attention. They can't integrate. I mean, it's a haunting line that was repeated throughout Jewish history in different contexts. Amar Rava, and Rava said, Lecha de yada lishna bisha ka Haman. There is nobody who knew Lashon Hara like Haman. And what they mean here is Haman had this incredibly effective rhetorical skill to use insinuation, an intimation, just by saying something and then building up this cloud. Again, he had this power to make something very small metastasize into a huge fear. So what did he say? Amar, he said, Yeshno Amne, there is this people. Na Talechu, let's go and get rid of them. Amar Le'achashverosh, we're told, responded, Mr. Finam Elohav, I can't go after the Jews, I'm scared of their God. Which, just reading the Megillah, you don't get that sense, but reading the last few daf, we've got the sense that the whole reason this party is happening right now is because Achashverosh is scared of the Jewish God, because he's seen his ancestors been defeated in wars because they misjudged when the 70 years was going to end. He's now confident the 70 years are over, their prophecy hasn't come true, they're not going back. That's the reason they're having this party now. And Haman says, well, we should kill them. And he says, look, the prophecy didn't happen, they didn't go back, but they still got a pretty powerful God. I'm not going to go after them. I don't want it to happen to me what happened to my forebears. Amalei, so Haman said, not Yeshno Amechad, there is one people, but Yashno, meaning they're sleeping. This one people, Yashno min ha-mitzvot. You're worried about their God, trust me. If you go after them, their God's going to be behind you. They're disengaged, they're apathetic. Look, they've all been at this party. They're happy to celebrate the end of their prophecy. Amalei Ibu Rabbanan. Achashverosh says that's true. They do seem to be disengaged and apathetic, but they're still the rabbis and they're pretty engaged. And I've seen them, they're scholars. Amalei, Haman responds, Am Echad. So when he says, Yeshno Am Echad, that's a condensed version of him saying there's a sleeping people and don't worry about that there are some, you know, good apples. Am Echad, they're a single people. And they all blur together. And this is Chazal saying, you see how gifted he is at rhetoric? We usually say, Am Echad, we're united. And he's saying, yeah, you're united. And you're dragged down by the worst of you, not you're brought up by the best of you. Shamatoma Karcha, unless you say, Karcha ani osev matecha, I'm going to create a vacuum in my kingdom. If I wipe out all the Jews, they'll just be packed as unused land. It'll create instability politically. That's why he says, Mufuzarin heim ba'amim. No, they're scattered out. It's not going to make a big deal. You're just going to pluck out Jews here and there. The politics will remain stable. Shamatoma idhanamino, but if he says, but they're productive people, they're good for the economy. Mufurad, that's why he says, not just that they're mufuzar, they're scattered, it won't ruin the stability of politics, but mufurad, which translates as, they're also kind of scattered, but he says the hint here is, kepreda. What is a preda?
Separation?
Yeah, in Hebrew that's often what it is, in kind of Aramaic term, preda can mean a mule, indeed. And a mule is famously unreproductive. So, kaprei dazusha in also peirot. You think they're productive, you think they're good with trade and good for the economy. Mufurad, they're just like a mule. Trust me, they do a lot of schlepping, they make a lot of noise. But if you get rid of them, you're not going to notice a difference. V'shem atoma ikim edintash, and if you say, well, there's a whole like Jewish Medina, like area that is dependent. So it's not going to be unstable for politics, but it's going to leave a whole patch of empty land. And they're important. Talmud loma b'chol medinat mechutecha, don't worry, they're everywhere. So again, it's kind of like Mufuzar. It's not that the politics will be unstable, but don't worry, there's not like a culture that you're going to ruin. This is weird people, they're scattered everywhere. V'dateyam shonot mekol am, they've got these different laws. Delo achli minan, they won't eat with us. V'lo nasni minan, and they won't marry their daughters to us. V'lo minzveilan, and they won't marry our daughters. So they're completely unintegrated and distinct. And not only that, v'dateyam melech enim osim, and they won't do the king's law. What is the king's law? And any of you who are familiar with JSketch or you've got Facebook, which I realized yesterday nobody has when I asked, what can you do? And JSketch is a small group of Orthodox connected Jewish comics. There was one that went wild and viral on Friday about, you'd find it amusing, about short Fridays in the winter, getting ready for Shabbos. You may have seen it come up. Either way, they did another one a few months ago about Jews around the Yom Narayim time when they get a new job and they're invited in and they say, so you're coming in on Monday? He says, well, actually it's Rosh Hashanah. I said, okay, so you're coming on a Tuesday? Well, there are 2 days Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so we'll see you Wednesday through the rest of the season. Well, next week's Yom Kippur. Okay, so you've been after that? No, then I've got Sukkot. Okay, so after, I said, well, there are 2 days and then another 2 days. They're like, okay, and Hanukkah? I said, oh no, I can come in on Hanukkah. I said, fine, for dads, except that Fridays, I can't come in any day. It just became a whole thing. So this is, obviously, they were thinking about this piece of Gemara. When Haman said to Achashverosh, and you're worried about these people, they don't keep your laws anyway. To Mafke Lekula Shatter, they spend the whole year saying, I can't work, B'shahi Pahi, which is an abbreviation for Shabbos Hayom, Pesach Hayom. Meaning, I can't come into work today. It's Shabbos today, it's Pesach today, it's, you know, it's Rosh Hashanah today, it's Tu B'Shvat today. I can't come into it. They spend the whole year doing that. Olamela, and you can see Chazal kind of playing on what they see as vulnerabilities where they are as well, which obviously remain a vulnerability throughout our diaspora, wherever you are. There are difficult. We're blessed that this is not the case now, and I'm sure some of us still have issues with getting out of work for religious reasons, and I'm sure we know stories about grandparents who people say, you know, they got fired every Friday and had to find a new job every Monday because they didn't come in on Shabbos. And we know the origins of the Hashkama Minyan movement. I'm sure some of you are familiar that it was for people who had to work on Shabbos. So they had an early Minyan on a Shabbos morning, went to Hashkama Minyan, went to work. And now, of course, Hashkama Minyan tends to be kind of the more, I don't know what the word would be. Yeah, let's go with that. Or it's a more streamlined, meaning I'm here just for davening. I don't want the floral presentation, and I just want to be here for davening. It seems to be more, there's a sense that we're more authentic, we're not about the performance. It used to be that it was a way to get in, sure, before.
No frills,
that's the word I was looking for. Thank you. Indeed. Okay. So that was Haman's penultimate line, and then he says, "V'melach ein shavala nicham," and they don't respect you, O king. And how do I know they don't respect you? He said, but they've been sitting at the party. They're here in the palace. Of course they respect me. They say, it looks like they respect you. But just put a little bit of focus on their laws, and you'll see they've got no respect to you. So they're going to eat here and drink here and disgrace you. Because if even a fly, something revolting, falls into their cup, they throw out the fly, and then they drink their drink. But if you touch their cup, they're going to throw it out. So they'll drink something repulsive when a fly's been in it, but if the king touches it, they throw it out. And is that accurate? Would Jews be able to drink it if it was Yad Nesach? No. And this was the challenge. I mean, we don't have to go down the historical avenues, but this was a challenge during emancipation. A lot of those in the 1700s who said we shouldn't give Jews civil rights, they're never going to integrate, they would say things that were inarguable. They'd say that Jews have messianic hopes. They want to go back to the land of Israel eventually. They're never going to be real patriots. And then the king would say to the Jews, is that true? Do you have hopes of returning to another land? And they'd be like, And said, will you not marry people in our country who are not Jewish? And this is why Napoleon set up what was called the Sanhedrin. We got together a group of rabbis, and he sent them a list of questions and said, I'm deciding whether to give you civil rights, and a lot is going to hang on your answers. And among them were, do you consider yourself Jews or Frenchmen? Would you marry people who are not Jewish, who are in France? And the Sanhedrin, which was obviously not the Sanhedrin, but it was a group of rabbis, had to find answers. And you can read it and you can see where they're kind of trying to obfuscate so they don't have to give the answer. And this is what Haman is doing. He's pushing on these buttons. And it's happened other times in Jewish history as well. Sometimes not only by people outside the community. This happened about 15 years ago. There was a rather prominent public intellectual who happens to be Jewish who was snubbed, not using names, by his observant high school. He went to the alumni celebration for his observant high school, and he brought his not Jewish partner with, and they had a big picture for the alumni gathering, and in the picture the face of his spouse had been blurred out or covered out or something, because they didn't, you know, well, I don't know if it was intentional or not, who knows, but he got this image and he was very upset. And he wrote, I think, if I'm not mistaken, to the New York Times about how Orthodox Jews behave horrifically. And if you wonder about what they really think, he said, ask them if they would save a non-Jewish life on the Sabbath. But they will save a Jewish life. And Rabbi Norman Lamb wrote a response to this, saying, well, you can look into it. But he didn't answer the question. He said, you've started this issue, you're going to answer it. You have to write a piece defending Jews now on what we feel about this. So sometimes, and is that true? By the way, is it true? We've not said, no, it happens to be that that's not true, that we would save a non-Jewish life on Shabbat. But if you go back into the annals of Jewish history, that's on the books. So sometimes you can say truths in a very harmful way. And that's what Haman's skill is here, to say things that are true, but to spin them to kind of gin up hostility. So at this point, Imal HaMelech Tov, after he's established all of this, he says, if it's good for the king, yikatev labdam, write a decree that they should all perish. And I'll give you 10,000 dinars of silver. Amay Shrakish, Reish Lakish jumps in at this point because Haman mentions give them money. It was known to God, of course, that Haman would use money against the Jews. That's why we have to bring the shekel every year before Haman deals with his shekel. And when do we have to bring the shekel? Rosh Chodesh Adar. So that's why it was taught in the Mishnah. That's why we say on the first of Adar, that's when we announce to bring the shekel, to kind of preempt Haman's economic plans. Last line of this. Amad. And the king, so Haman said, write up a decree and I'll give you money and I'll invest in this project and we'll get rid of them. And the king said to Haman, Hakesef natun lach. Says, you hold on to your money. I don't need you to pay me for this. You just do whatever you want. Rabbah, now onto Adaf Yudalad at the top. Rabbah says, let me give you a parable, bless you. Let me give you a mashal for how this works, this dynamic. Achashresh v'Haman lamadadeva. What can this be compared to? L'shnei ben Adam, two people. Echad hayelo tel b'toch sadeh. Someone's got a mound of earth in their field. Echad hayelo charis b'toch sadeh. And someone's got a ditch in their ground. And they're wandering around. The one with the mound is saying, the one with the ditch, l'chad hayelo charis b'toch sadeh. Ubal charis amar. The one with the ditch says, mutinly tells Evdomim, I wonder if I could. He sees that mound in the other field. Says, I would buy that. I really want that. When I see the guy, I'm not asked to buy it. Balatelam, and the person who's got the mound in his field doesn't want it there, says, me tenli charizev. Oh, I see that ditch. I wish I could pay to use it. Next time I see him, I'm going to pay him so I can put my stuff in that ditch. Liyamim, eventually, a few days later, they come in contact with Yishar Amal Bal Charizev Bal Hatel, and the ditch owner says to the mound owner, Malchi Telech, do me a favor, sell me your mound so I can fill in my ditch. Amalo says, Tulo Tabachinam Valavai, says, no, no, just take it. I just want it out. Please, just take it for free. And that's what we have here. Well, Haman and Mordechai, they both have a problem, the way this mashal is, from Abba. Neither of them want the Jews. Is it relevant that one sees them as a ditch and one sees them as a mound? Of course it is, because it's the Talmud. We're going to put pressure on everything, and there are different readings. And who's the one who sees the Jews as a ditch, according to this mashal? Who approaches who and says, I'll pay you for that? Haman approaches, and who in the mashal does it? The guy with the ditch or the guy with the mound? It was a 50-50, correct. The guy with the ditch comes and says, can I buy your mound to fill in the ditch? And so a number of the later commentaries say there is a huge difference between Haman and Mordechai. Haman, I'm drunk obviously, between Haman and Achashverosh. Achashverosh sees the Jews as a mound, meaning he recognizes them as a powerful people that maybe threatens the integration of their kingdom. And that's also been borne out in the way that he's holding a party. He's trying to integrate them. He doesn't want to destroy them. He wants to assimilate them somehow and kind of bring them into his land. And Haman sees them as a ditch. These are an empty people. They're worthless. I want to get rid of them. I want to kind of flatten them and kind of fill them in, cover them up. And at this point, they come together. And even though they've got different perspectives, they've got the same ends. And it suggests that there is an inherent danger. Even if somebody seems warm, says, oh, I want you to become part of me. Talking again about the emancipation, those who wanted Jews to assimilate, not those who said, we're not going to give it to them, but there was two forces. You got the romantic force who says, you're not part of our culture, get out. And you had the enlightened force who said, oh, you're human, come in, but drop the Judaism. And both of them are threatening forces because it doesn't let you be who you are. And they both see you as a threat to their system. And it ends up they come together to agree. And Lahavdil, that's what happened in the 20th century, 1930s and 40s. These two forces where you've got the enlightened elite come together with the base forces of the romantic nationalism. And they say, yeah, we've both got a problem. Let's come together and deal with this. And that's what you have coming here with Haman and Achashverosh. V'yatzar ha-melech ad-dabato, so the king removed his ring and said, here you go, Haman, you do whatever you want. And this is the trigger for the next stuff, which we're going to run through at relative speed. It doesn't tell you relative to what. Amar Barbrokana, Barbrokana says, Gedola hasarat tabat, this removing this ring was greater. Yotem Rab Amishman Nevi Meshev Nevi Yos, was greater than the 48 prophets and the 7 prophetesses, Shnavu Lehen Yisrael, who prophesied to the Jews, Shukulan Lo'achzi Ram Lemutav, because none of them made the Jews good. They never managed to have them repent. But removing this ring, in an instant, everybody came better. So, this may be the rhetorical spin of Rabbi Abba Rukana, who's frustrated in the rabbi, says, no one ever listens to me. And the commentators do observe that, of course, there are moments when the Jews did repent. But overwhelmingly, the sense is, religious figures, prophets, rabbis, sages, spend our time trying to get everybody to repent. And occasionally you succeed. An anecdote here or there, but on the whole, people don't pay attention. And here, the king removes a ring and everybody's panicked. We need to repent. Woe is me. Let's go to the streets. Let's cover ourselves in ash and have a fast. There is a power to raw politics that even the most persuasive prophet does not have, is the observation here. And we're now going to break into a discussion about who the prophets are. But first, Tanur Rabban and the rabbis taught. First, red line. There were 48 prophets, 7 prophetesses who prophesied to the Jews. And they did not add or detract anything from Jewish life and law, with the exception, they added that you should read the Megillah, meaning there was something about the Purim story that you can't find in the Torah. There's something novel, something new, something fresh of equal weight. That it should be in the canon, that was not there already. As a side point, I put in the red in Rashi on the top, the last wide line of Rashi. Vimtomaneh Chanukah, you say, hold on, there's an extra. What about Chanukah? That's also added to the canon. We don't read anything for Chanukah, but there's the Ner Chanukah is added. Rashi says, Pascha and Nevi'im, the Nevi'im already stopped. Avol Bei Mordechai Hayu Chagai Zecharia Malachi, meaning that was already a completely rabbinic institution. But the Megillah was instituted at the time of the rebuilding of the Second Temple. There were still prophets around at this point. Daniel was around, Malachi, Chagai, Zechariah around. So this was still in the prophetic era when something was added. First word on the line is my, fourth red line. My drush, how did they come to this conclusion that we should add Mikra Megillah? Amr b'chir ba'avin, Amr b'shu ben karcha. It was reported in the name of Shu ben karcha. Umay ma'avdu l'cheret amashira. Just as when we go from slavery to freedom, we say Shira. When do we go from slavery to freedom? Pesach. We say Shira, meaning we do Hallel. Mimita lachaim lakol shekein. So, meaning if you survive, if you're freed from servitude, you sing. If you're freed from the threat of death, of course you should sing. So there should be a Hallel. At which point you're thinking, we don't say Hallel. Lihachi halanami name. Maybe we should say Hallel then. Fine, I understand you want to tell the story. It's important. But what about Hallel? Lefi, and then we've got basically three answers to this question. Number one, Lefi Shein Omrim Halal al Nesha b'chutz laretz. Number one, we don't say a halal about a miracle that happens in chutz laretz. Your first response to that is? Yeah. Well, that was your first response. Right? So why not? But also, there was an example of one that took place in chutz laretz that we definitely do say halal on. Correct. You see, I'm pretty sure that leaving Egypt happened outside Israel. How do I know? Correct. Shouldn't we say halal then? Kedetanya. You know the answer to that. It was taught. Adshlo nichnasu Yisrael eretz. Before we came into then, huchshu kolar silam ashar, that we were able to say on any miracle. Mishenichnus laretz Yisrael. Once we got into the land, huchshu kolar silam ashira, there was a focus of Jewish attention into the land of national autonomy. And there are no more songs about Chutz Laretz miracles. Now, you could ask the question, why? That's a good question, and I don't have the authoritative answer. There are many who have suggested different answers, mutually exclusive answers, about maybe because once we got into the land, divine providence only really unfolds in the land. And anything that happens outside, you can't accredit God with. It's just chance, and God only focuses on the land of Israel. And that is a heavy stream of Jewish thought among the thinkers about how providence works. There's not really a good rational explanation for why that would be the case. If God's all powerful, he just leaves like the rest of the universe to chance apart from on this strip of land. Abarbanel's got a whole treatise dedicated to explaining this. But others think providence is either universal or it's not. So maybe there's another reason. There was one suggestion that actually, almost inverse, in Chutz La'aretz, it would be impossible for Jews to survive without a miracle every moment. You're out in the middle of the world, surrounded by enemies who want to hurt you. The fact that you haven't assimilated, if you were saying Halal in Chutz La'aretz, you'd be saying it every breathing moment that you made it. In Israel, you've got independence, you've got strength, so saying Halal is a more specific, oh, I can now pinpoint this miracle, I'm going to say halal. And Chosarot, you can't do that. So those are inverse views. But I'm not privy to the workings of Providence, so I can't answer you one way or other. Answer number two, why don't we say halal on Purim? One we said was because you don't say miracle, you don't say halal on miracles and Chosarot. Number two, Rav Nachman says, Kriyata zu halila. No, we do say halal on Purim, actually. And that's the Megillah. The Megillah is halal. You don't need halal because we've got the Megillah. Number three, Rava Amar Bishla Mahatam. Actually, there's a big difference between what happens in Purim and Pesach. It's true that one is surviving the threat of death and one is being freed from servitude. But as a wise man once said, there are things far worse than death. I think that was Dumbledore who said that. But Rava predates him. Bishlam ha'atam, it makes sense in Egypt. Halal lilo avdei Hashem. What do we say in halal? We say, blessed are, thank you God, we're now servants of God. Vlavdei paro. And when you free, when you're given liberty, who was it in America who said, give me liberty?
Patrick Henry.
There you go, Patrick Henry. That was his name?
Yeah.
I thought that was like a double barrel. Just Patrick Henry? All right, so give me liberty or give me death. You say, I prefer to be dead than enslaved. And this is what Rava is suggesting, that when you leave Mitzrayim, you're now servants of God and not Paro. Elahacha, hey, halu avdei Hashem. You can't say we're the servants of God. Avdei Achashverosh, they were still servants of Achashverosh. Akadi, avdei Achashverosh anan. So how could you possibly say halal? So it's an astonishing moment. We say, you're right, we survived the threat of genocide, but we were no freer than we were before. That, you know, that would have been a horrific tragedy, but we're not free yet. We don't have liberty yet. And so again, you see kind of latent politics, religious politics beneath this of what our views are as Jews in the diaspora. First wide line, end of the line. Ben of Rav Ben Nachman Kashman. The Gemara says, hold on, there's a problem, both with Rava and Rav Nachman. The last two views said, we don't say halal on Purim because either the Megillah is halal, or because it doesn't really warrant it, because we weren't fully free at the end of the story. At which point the Gemara says, hold on, we can't even talk about this. What happened to the first view that says you can't say halal if a miracle happened in Chutz Laaretz? You don't even get off the ground for Rava. And Rav Nachman, Gemara responds for Hatanya, and this is also an important observation for the rabbis. It was taught, Mishenichnu le'itzoyuch shu kol ha'atzala mashira. We already said you can't say halal in Chutz Laaretz. Answer, kivin shigalu chazu la'achshiran harisha. Once you go into exile, you can start saying halal for miracles in the diaspora. Now that, again, I haven't been sleeping properly, so I don't know if this is entirely accurate. It strikes me that that obliterates both explanations that were given for why you can't say Shira and Chutz Laaretz, unless providence changes. When you're exiled, providence is now more effective outside the land of Israel, or we're less likely to survive, or more likely, it kind of shatters the impression, other than it seems to me the more coherent explanation in this instance is that when you have autonomy, that is the focus of the national psyche. And if some miracle happens abroad, that's a wonderful thing, but that doesn't dictate national affairs. That's not something we're going to say, we're now going to make a rule, we're all going to say Shira. It's a wonderful turn of events, but it's local. It's not a national event. Because the center of the Jewish psyche is national autonomy. It is the land. But once we're all in exile, once we're a diasporic people, the psyche is virtual. Our center point is our culture. We're not landed anymore in the diaspora. So therefore, if something great happens in the diaspora, we can all sing Shira about it and kind of absorb that into our psyche and build into our memory. Being expelled from Spain is not a small detail in the Jewish psyche. It's a central trope that we have because we were all in the diaspora. And now, with the land of Israel, that impacts where the center of Jewish life is. But once we're in exile, the rabbis say, you can start saying halal about what happens outside again. Full stop. And now we're going to have... that was the limit of our discussion related to Purim and prophecy. And now we turn Vatu Leka, and I'm sorry this is hard to read. Vatu Leka, you're telling me there were no more than 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses? There must have been more than that. You're telling me there were only, you know, if you get a list of rabbinic figures of the 19th century, you get a list of, I don't know, 120 rabbinic figures. Vatu Leka, there were only 120 rabbis in the 19th century, so there were only 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses. Vaktiv, surely it says... at the beginning of the Good Shmuel, there was one man who came from Ramatayim Sofim, and the interpretation of Ramatayim Sofim, which is just a place name, is Echad Mimataim Sofim, one of 200 seers, Shenitnavu Lem Yisrael, who were prophesying for the Jews. Mia Tuvahavo, yeah, you're right, there were more than 48. There was one of 200 in that one instance from Sofim. So, and we know there were more, because Itanya, there's a bride that says, Harbin of Imam Dulein Yisrael. In fact, there were so many prophets in Israel, Kiflaim Kis Mitzrayim, double the amount of the people who left Egypt, saw themselves as prophets. So, what does it mean to be a prophet then? Again, we usually think prophet means I'm chosen by God to reveal a message. If there were 1.2 million prophets wandering around, it seems difficult to suggest that God gave them all the chosen message. It's possible. But we'll try to indicate prophecy might be a little different than that. So this is a kind of a well-known line. Of course, there were many prophecies, but the ones were of eternal purchase. The prophecies that have resonance for eternity, they were recorded, and they were the 48 prophets and the 7 prophetesses, and everything else was kind of a local transient issue. What I'll note, I was going to print it out for all of you, but I thought I'll just print it out for me and read it to you briefly, is 3 sentences from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks about what prophecy means and how it's radically different to ancient cultures that also had similar things like oracles that would predict the future. This is what Rabbi Sacks says. A prophet is not an oracle. A prophecy is not a prediction. Precisely because Judaism believes in free will, the human future can never be unfailingly predicted. People are capable of change. God forgives, as we say in our prayers on high holidays, prayer, penitence, and charity avert the evil decree. There is no decree that cannot be revoked. A prophet does not foretell. And this is key. He says, a prophet warns. A prophet does not speak to predict future catastrophe, but rather to avert it. And this is his italicized sentence. If a prediction comes true, it has succeeded. If a prophecy comes true, it has failed. And that's a big distinction. And this is in the context of him writing about Jonah being really disappointed that he went to Nineveh and told them it's all going to be destroyed. And then they repent. And he turns to God and says, you made me look like an idiot. I said it's all going to get destroyed and 40 days are going to come. And it won't be because they've all repented. And God says, yes, well done. That's the point. He says, but now they're not going to know if I was right or not. He said, that's not the point. The point is you told them to do what was right. And it's true. People who give good advice and warn people about catastrophe, if they're followed, often it doesn't happen. We spoke about this in our community a little bit around the beginning of COVID, when there were lots of different views about what to do. And at one point we said, right, we're going to close the shul because we think if we kept it open, something awful would happen. But it's very challenging because closing the shul, you can't prove that you were right. We could say, you know what, let's leave it open, let everybody get infected, and then we'll say, see, we told you something awful would happen, then you'd be failing as a leader. So sometimes you'd have to say, trust me, something awful will happen, and risk looking stupid. And that's what Jonah had to face. And to some degree, we're now going to try to prove who the prophets are, why they're prophets, and we've already said, what's the point of prophecy? We said that the ring succeeded where prophets had failed. What did the ring do? Did it predict anything? It changed people's behavior. That's what the ring did. It said, Shehuchzaran lemutav. The single act made everybody repent. That's the point of prophecy, it seems. We say they're better than all the prophets are doing that. The ring doesn't predict. It just enables a psychological change on the part of the people.
But it was something actual.
What do you mean?
It was concrete.
Yes.
They were saying something. He said it was done already.
Well, it wasn't done. The Jews weren't destroyed. There was just a movement of a ring. Nothing actually had happened. There was just a warning.
No, so, permission to destroy them. I mean, that's actual.
Nothing had happened yet.
Well, it's like the Wannsee Conference.
Yeah, which is nothing's happened, but this is something is going to. It's a warning. Things are in motion. The prophet does the same thing. Nothing's happened yet, but I'm telling you it's actual. I'm telling you, when the prophet says something, it's the equivalent of the one seat conference. Meaning, God has decided, I've just come from the conference, it's happening. The people say, eh. But the ring moves, and they say, oh, it's happening, it's actual. Convinced or just given up? Okay. Either way, I'll take it as a win.
Now you know how I
do. All right, we'll work on it. So we've got a slight review of what prophecy means in this context, that it's not about predicting, it's about changing behavior. And it's true, it's more concrete, and maybe, I mean, we're more terrestrial, so it feels more concrete. Of course, we know with the historical record, did anything happen? Was it meaningful that this ring moved? What happened as a result of it? Haman died and we survived. That's what happened. And look at the historical record. There was fear for a while, and then we won, we celebrate, and he's dead on a tree. That's what the ring actually did. But because we're very terrestrial and we're very chronological and we're embedded in history, we see events before our eyes as far more effective and concrete than aphoristic warnings from prophets. And here the suggestion is, well, that's kind of inverted. If a prophet tells you something could happen, that's far more concrete than just a political gesture that who knows what will happen. And the proof of the pudding is, it didn't actually help him in the end. But yet that's far more effective. So there's a suggestion here for the rabbis that we should pay attention to politics and that maybe we shouldn't ignore political gestures for affecting human behavior. Okay, Vetuleka. Okay, we're going to have to accelerate, forgive me. Vaktiv. Oh, we already did that. So we know there are many, many more people than just the 48 and the 7, but we only record the perpetually important ones. There is another two readings of what Ramatai means, not one of 200, but Reb Shmuel bar Nachmani Omar, you want to know what that verse means in Shmuel, that a man came from a time so fim? It means, Adam haba mishtei ramot shesufa zozo, he came from two mountains that see each other. For a number of commentaries, they suggest, well, these are nice kind of extra readings, I don't know what that's got to do with anything. We could read this as also saying what it means to be a prophet. We've said one man comes from Ramah time. We say that proves there's more than one prophet. There are many, many prophets, which again suggests these are people who are offering warnings, who are trying to suggest. And if any of you have seen kind of these comedic sketches, again, I don't want to give too much attention to Life of Brian, but the kind of thing where you walk through the market and everybody's a prophet, everybody's standing up saying their piece. The suggestion is that that's real. People would stand up and say, I'm warning you of what's going to happen. And the suggestion here is they were true prophets. They weren't false. They weren't like lying. But it just wasn't eternally relevant. Shmuel Nachmani said, a second view is he came, and what it means to be a prophet is to come from one mountain that can see another, suggesting that prophecy is about being able to distinguish between the peaks and the troughs, what are important, what's pertinent information, what isn't, and also having a long view. It means that he came from... this person who came down came from people who stood on the towers of the world. Who are the people who stood on the towers of the world? B'nei Korach, children of Korach, Tichtivnei Korach Lametu, we read in Bamidbar that the children of Korach didn't die, despite the fact they participated in the rebellion. Tanu Misham, Rabbeinu was told in the name of Rabbi Yudan Asi, Markum Shnit Basilehem, Begehenum V'amadu Alav. There was a place in hell that stood out for them to stand upon. And this goes back to a Midrash that suggests in the last moment Korach's children repented. The fact they were involved in this rebellion, and as everybody else was being swallowed by the ground, the B'nai Korach in particular said, oh, this is awful, we should never have been part of this, and then suddenly something protruded and saved them from falling down into the hole. And this is when B'nai Korach wrote Lam Natsach Livnei Korach, the Psalms that we say in their name, and they were the ancestors of Shmuel, and that's why that he's described in that way. Okay, more to say, but let's move on. Sheven Neviyos Ma'aneinu, there were seven prophetesses. Who were they? Line in blue, Sarah, Miriam, Dvorah, Hannah, Avigal, Huldah, and Esther. Those are the seven prophetesses. Now we'll go one by one at some speed. We may not get through all of them. Proving that all seven were indeed prophetesses. How do I know they're prophetesses? Number one, Sarah. How do I know she was a prophetess? Dechtiv, Avimalka, Avi, Yizkeh. The end of Parashat Noach, it lists the father of Malka and Yizkeh. Sarah isn't mentioned by name at this point. And it says, and Avram married one of them, and it says, and he married Sarah. Sounds like the same person, at which point, Amram Yitzchak, Yitzchak was Sarah, Yitzchak, why was she called Yitzchak? She tzachat Abaruch HaKodesh, because she had the capacity to foresee with divine insight. How do I know she had the capacity to foresee beyond the fact that this name has that illusion? Where do we have a case where she is authoritative when she speaks? Kicks out Yishmael, and who says she's right? Right, that's good on her side. Whatever Sarah says, you should listen to her. That indicates God is saying she is a truth teller. She is a prophetess. Again, does that mean she's predicting? Or does that mean she's capable of foreseeing what will happen, even if it doesn't happen? It's not that it is assured once the prophet says it, but it is an accurate portrayal of what's unfolding. Davar Acher, there's another reading of the word Yizkeh. Yizkeh shakol sochem biofya. Maybe it means that everybody stared at her, not that she could look into the future, but everybody would look at her because of her beauty. Again, a couple of the commentaries say, why are you adding this here? You know, how does that contribute to our discussion that she was a prophetess? Some suggest the reason it says this is because Yiska is far more descriptive then. If it means that she could foresee the future, call her Yiska. Why is she called Sarah? So there's an implication. It will actually would also imply other things. So we don't want to use that name. We use something else. There's one reading, other reasons too. Miriam, how do I know Miriam was a prophetess? Tick, too. It says, Yigach Miriam Hanavi'a, clue, Achod Aaron. It says, Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron. Which, right, nepotism.
Yeah, Moshe wrote that.
So how do I know Moshe the prophet? We'll get there. So Miriam is a prophetess. How do I know? Because it says Miriam is a prophetess. But there is a continuation that explores this. V'lochal Aaron. Why does it say this came up in last week's parasha? How do I know? Why is she described right after the Shira as Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron? She had a very prominent other brother, which Achot Moshe could have said. Amram Nachman Amarav. Why does it say Achot Aaron? Shahaita Mendebeit Kishi Achot Aaron. It's telling us she's been a prophetess since the days of Aaron, meaning before Moses was born, she was a prophetess. That's why she's called the sister of Aaron. What did she say where before Moshe was born? Omeret, Atida Amit Shetela Ben Yeshe Israel. My mother is going to give birth to the Savior of Israel. And this is the based around the Midrash, that she told her parents to get back together. You're going to have a child. That child's going to save the Jewish people. B'shashanola, Malakol Beta Kula Ora. And when Moshe was born, the whole house filled with light. At that point, Amad Aviv and Ishgal Roshah, father stood up and gave her a kiss on the head and said, Amala Bitin, come in Vuatech. Said, wow, you were right, Miriam. That's amazing. Your prophecy is coming true. This doesn't last, as parents may reflect on their relationship with children's predictions. Once Moshe had to be thrown into the river in this basket, father stood up and kind of knocked her on the head, and said, hey, where's your prophecy gone? You said he would save the Jewish people, we had a happy moment, and now look at him, he's gone in the river with everybody else. What's happened to your prophecy? That's why it said, that's why it says she stood at a distance to watch. And this is interesting, we got into watching the Prince of Egypt in our home the last couple of weeks, because Bluey, I just had enough. I don't know if you've heard of Bluey. It's this Australian show of dogs being... Is it?
Yeah.
They're so mean to each other all the time. I have to spend a lot of time compensating for the things they tell. Either way, we've been watching Prince of Egypt, and at one point, one of my daughters said, why does Miriam, follow to watch? She, can't help. She goes, because the alligator nearly eats him. So just so she can see, she's not going to dive in, and she doesn't try to help. So why is she watching? And the suggestion so she could report back because she was curious, whatever. The response of the Gemara is, "Ladat ma yeh basaf nevoata," that she wanted to see what would happen to her prediction. Meaning her father just slapped her on the head and said, see what happened to your prediction. She's saying, no, I can't believe it's over. And she watches to see what unfolds. That's the reason she's watching. It's not like she's going to jump in and save him from the alligators or from the palace guards. But that's the reading here. So now that we've seen that, I can tell my daughter. Dvara. How do I know Dvara was a prophetess? Again, another very good clue. Dichtiv, Dvara Isha Neviya. Dvara was a female prophet. Eshet Lapidot. She was the... how do you translate Eshet Lapidot?
Wife of Mr. Lapidot.
The wife of Lapidot. My Eshet Lapidot. But what is that? Who is Lapidot? And usually you would only describe somebody as being the spouse of somebody if that somebody was more prominent than them. Yitro Choten Moshe. But Devorah Eshet Lapidot. Who's Lapidot? Why is he getting mentioned here? So maybe it must be something else. A suggestion. What does that mean? Shaita Osip Tilot Lemikdash. Lapid, not Yair, but Lapid means wick. So Yair Lapid is actually a very interesting name, but putting that aside, Lapid means a torch, like an American torch, not an English torch, the big flamey thing. She, Oseb Tilot LeMikdash, she would make the wicks for the Mikdash. So that's why she's called Eshet Lapid. It doesn't mean the wife of, it means the woman of wicks. That's actually in Tanakh, that's the way Rashi reads Eshet Lapidot. The Abarbanel objects to that, the Ralbag objects to that, and the Abarbanel says, just translate it literally, assuming that it does mean torch. Eshet Lapidot means she was a fiery woman, and she was on the one hand a prophetess, and on the other hand also a woman of bold action. She led an army, and that's what you need for a leader, someone who is plugged in spiritually, but also interested in leading the people through action. But this is how the Gemara reads it. She made the Petilot, but he Yoshevet Tachat Tomer, and it also describes her as sitting beneath the date tree. Maishna Tachat Tomer, who cares that she sat beneath the date tree? Why are we being told that that's where she would sit? I mean, it's a nice image. Amr Shumaram Shalom, Mishum Yichud. Why did she sit beneath the date tree? because it's unusual to have a female leader, especially in ancient times. And people would often come to see the leader and spend time in seclusion with the leader, trying to resolve issues. And she said, I can't pick like a willow, because if there's a willow tree, it'll create a kind of curtain. So I'm going to sit beneath a date tree where there aren't big hanging leaves. And that means that everyone can see. So people keep their distance, have private conversations. But yichud means no one will suspect when I'm secluded with people that anything nefarious is happening. And that's why I sit beneath a date tree. So while it's a pretty picture, Chazal say it's more than that. It's an indication of her devotion to Jewish law, fidelity, family structures, etc. Davar Acher, there's another reading. Just as the palm tree has only one heart, I don't know the tree biology, but I'm told that in most trees, sap moves all the way through the structure, but in a date tree, in a palm tree, it goes only up and down the central trunk, and sap doesn't go into the leaves or the branches. I don't know what that means per se, but that's what it means, that it's got one heart. So too in the age of Devarah, she sat beneath the Torah, meaning that was an epitome, a symbol of the Jewish people in that age, that they had a single heart connected to God. Suggesting again, what's the point of a prophet? Not predict things, to be an oracle, but to unite people, to bring people together, to lift them up. Chana, how do I know Chana was a prophet? It says when Chana prayed, this is, she is the, who is Chana the mother of? Shmuel, the beginning of the book of Shmuel, and she has a prayer, and she says, "Alatz libi b'Hashem, my heart will rejoice in God. Rama karni b'Hashem, my keren, meaning like the horn, will rejoice or be uplifted for God." And we take that now as a prophecy. How is that a prophecy? Rama karni v'la rama pachi. It says, "My horn will rejoice, not my how do you say pach container, vessel, cup, jug." Will rejoice. Why does she say Keren rather than Pach? Because David and Shlomo shimshku beKeren shimshku machlatam. Because David and Solomon, who were anointed with a horn, their dynasty carried on for a long time. Shaul veYehu, but Shaul and Yehu shimshku bePach, who were anointed with a jug, lo nimshku machlatam. They did not have longevity on the throne. So it was understood. This sounds more like a prediction than a kind of warning. But like, just sounds like an arbitrary thing. Like, oh, if you're anointed with a horn, it'll last for a long time. She says that, that must mean she's a prophetess, because it came true. David and Solomon had long reigns, Yehu and Shaul did not. Presumably there are other ways to read it, that there's something more stable about a horn, etc., etc. We'll leave that to the side. But she continues in that prayer to say, "In Kadosh Kashem, ki en biltecha." There is no one like God, none beyond you. There's got to be more than just this repetition. She's not saying there's no one like God, no one like you. She's saying there's no one like God, no one lebiltecha should be read. Don't read biltecha. There is none like you. But there are none who outlive you. Levala is to be worn out. Don't think that anybody will be worn out after you. Because God is not like human beings. To human beings, when we make things, they outlive us. And this is, you know, a fact of human life. You know, we can build homes, we can make extensions, we can write books, we can carve objects, and then they're heirlooms, and they outlast us and live beyond us. God outlives everything else. And this is, you know, in a human context, this would almost be tragic. I think of there's a movie called Bicentennial Man. I don't know how many of you have seen or come across it. Robin Williams is an android that's very humanoid and keeps outliving everything around him. He's almost played by immortality. He develops friendships, and then he finds himself, you know, friendly with the grandchildren of his best friend from when he was, you know, back. And it's very difficult. In fact, he's so difficult, he says, you know what, I just want to transplant all of my technology with organs to become human so that I will die. Because immortality, I'm living for too long. But here, God is different to man. God makes things and just outlasts all of them. And that's what she is suggesting. And some of the commentaries say this is just an additional none to do with our subject. But it sounds also like what we're suggesting is, this is what marks her as a prophetess. It's not just that she happened to predict that David and Solomon will have a long reign, but she recognizes the awesome difference that God has in the weakness of human beings. Ein Tzur Kelokeinu says there is no rock like God. What does that mean? Ein Tziar Kelokeinu, there's no artist like God. Adam Sar Tzura Al Gabi Hakotel, human beings draw a picture on the wall. Ve'en Yachol La'atel Baruch Neshama Karam Ma'am. You can't bring it to life. You draw a picture, it's just a still image. Aval Kadosh Baruch Hu Tzar Tzura B'toch Tzura, but God creates a forms a fashion within a fashion, meaning God will have an embryo conceived within another one of his creatures. Matil Baruch Neshama Kram Min Ha'Olam, and start developing organic innards and life. That's remarkably different. So we see here, Chana, what makes her a prophetess? I mean, I understand how we prove Devorah and we prove that Sarah says Neviyah, and in one case, and in the other case, God says, listen to her. We had Miriam, who was also called Neviyah and predicts what's going to happen. What is it about Chana? It sounds like that she's got this sense of the limits of humankind, that we are not true artists, that the things we make outlive us, and the things we make are remarkably shallow compared to what God can do, and that puts us in a very difficult spot. And her recognition of human limits is what prepares her to warn people about how things can go awry. Meaning, you think you can assure a future as a human being? I'm telling you, things will fall apart. We are limited in our scope and in our power, and maybe that marks her as a prophetess, in addition to her ability to predict David and Solomon. Let's keep going for a little bit. Avigail. Avigal said, "Dechtiv Hadron Avigal was a prophetess. Vayi rochevet al chamor." This is a very strange story. Avigal was riding on a donkey. We already besayt her home. She came down the secret side of a mountain. Now, a little bit of background. This story: David has been anointed as a king. For those of you who are not familiar with the story, Shaul is king. He ends up disobeying the prophet. He was told to kill Amalek, and he says, "Maybe me." And he keeps the Amalekite king alive. Shmuel the prophet comes along and says, Shaul, it's over. You've disappointed God, you lose the throne, and it will be taken away from you. But it's not like he executes the king, so the king's still on the throne, but he then goes by God's command to go and anoint David. David is quietly anointed, so he's now been anointed king. Well, there's still a king, and Shaul is now chasing David because he heard that David was anointed. That's a whole drama of the end of Samuel 1 of Shmuel Aleph, that Shaul is chasing David to kill him. They find him in Ein Gedi. He finds him up on a mountain. He finds him in the city of Nov. There are priests who are killed. There are cities that are burned. There is more than one episode where actually they meet each other. David and Shaul end up seeing each other. And David says, I could have killed you and I didn't. Please understand that I don't want to hurt you. And Shaul says, I'm so sorry, you're right. I don't mean to hurt you. And then 10 minutes later, he's trying to kill him again and throwing arrows at him. So it's a kind of very dramatic unfolding. And in one moment when David's on the run, he says, me and my men are running out of food. Oh, there's a very wealthy person, though, called Naval. I'm going to go to Naval, and I'm going to tell Naval to please give us some food to support us. At which point Naval says, who the heck is David? I'm not supporting David. Who are you and who's Yishai? Get out of my face. At which point David says, that's not very nice. We should kill him. So he's now riding on the way to Naval's house to say, you don't want to support us? I'm the king. I've been anointed. I'm going to kill him. At this point, Avigail is the wife of Naval. Avigail will come back in the story of David much later, the end of his life, when he needs company. But now she's the wife of Naval, and she says, I can't have my husband slaughtered. I've got to protect the family and the estate. So she gets on a donkey and goes toward David to try to convince him not to kill her husband. So it says she came down the secret side of the mountain. Why does it have to say she came down the secret side of the mountain? What does that contribute to the story? Just say she came down the mountain. Amar Rishmol says, Al Iske Dam Haba Min Har Starim. It indicates she came down the secret part of the mountain. It means she came down the mountain with a secret, meaning with an issue surrounding something private. She was going to distract him by asking him a question about Damnida. She thought, I need to save my husband. How am I going to do this? I'm going to bring him a Mara and ask him a Shaila. How is that going to help? Amar La. He says to her, she meets David, shows him this Mara. And again, the commentaries say there's another midrash that suggests David was in the business of doing this. People would often go to David with these questions. And says to David, could you just interpret this for me? And he says, V'chi marin dam ba'layla, what are you talking about? We don't do this at night. I need sunlight in order to inspect the color. At which point she says, V'chi dan din nefashos ba'layla, okay, do you do capital cases at night? Boom! And he says, oh, wow, you got me there. Amalai, he responds, no, you didn't get me. This is not a case of capital punishment that you need the courts for. This is a rebellion against the king. And I've got jurisdiction at any point to make a judgment about what threatens the state. I can do this. This is equivalent of, you know, a president ordering an assassination on a terrorist. or somebody being indicted for capital punishment. I don't need to have a court. I don't need to have a judge. I don't need due process. There's a threat, and I'm using my judgment. At which point she says, Amra lo adain shol kayam, shol still alive, v'lo yatzta tevach bo'olam, and your name has not spread around the world. If you do this, it will be seen as an act of extrajudicial killing. It will lead to instability, and it will rip the people apart. If you were king and you had the authority, and everybody understood that, you're right, you have authority as a king. But it's not understood at this point. And it sounds like she's actually not just trying to protect her husband. She's trying to protect the people, saying, if you do this, it's going to create a massive fracture. You're never going to be able to reign properly. Amalah, so his response is, Baruch ta'amechu brucha at. And this again is a quote from the story, which he says, blessed are your reasons, you saved me, mavo b'damim, for coming into blood. Although I mistranslated that. It doesn't say thank you for not making me come to blood, but b'damim, bloods. Oh, but tarte, it sounds like. Damim tarte mashma, sounds like there were two things she saved him from doing. So number one is, he didn't kill Naval, but what's number two? Melamed shegilta et shokah. This teaches us that she must have somehow revealed her leg at some point on the journey. And it was such a sight of beauty, it transmitted an image three parasangs. Amala, and David came running towards her in kind of a state of deep yearning and craving, and said, Ishmaeli, listen to me, which is code for lie with me. Amra lo, she said to him, lo tiazot lecha lefukad, this should not be for you a stumbling block. Meaning, thank you, but no, thank you. We should not do this. So there are two things she saved David from doing. Number one, from committing an affair. And number two, from killing extrajudicially. That's why it says, you saved me. Which tells us a lot about the character of David and the story, etc., etc. But either way, what is that last line? Lo tiazot, this should not be a stumbling block. And this is how we prove she's a prophet. So far, the Gemara indicates that there are suggestions. She's aware of the human condition. She's aware of what a kingdom requires. But I need to know that she's got something that is somewhat predictive. Zot says, this will not be a stumbling block. Michlal de'ikachriti, this implies something else will be a stumbling block for you and my new one. What is that? Master's about Sheva. The episode about Sheva, when she turns to him and says, this should not be a stumbling block for you. She's basically saying, I can see that this is going to be a recurrent issue. Don't let this be the thing that gets you. But maybe there'll be something else like this that will. And in the end, it was that did it. We're going to just push through to the end of this. Red. Oh, let's see. V'haita nefeshat nitzvah b'tzorachayim. Something, a statement which we often say in the context of people passing away, that their soul should be bound up in the bonds of life. We quote Avigail here. Here she says just goodbye to David and says, your soul should be bound up in the bonds of life. Ki havat miftrei minei. And at that point, after she said that, she left. Amrale, and she said to him, V'hitav Hashem la'aduni, may God be good to you, my master. V'zacharte et ametecha, and please remember your maidservant. Why she say, remember your maidservant? In case of, right, it's almost like maybe in better circuit, you wanted to have a relationship, maybe in a different time, in a different life, in a different place, that's what she says. And of course, in a different time, in the same life, but in a different place, they do happen to get together in many years from now, at which point the Gemara is again suggesting, and this indicates a prophetic capacity, that she's got an intimation that their paths will cross. There's something supernatural about her predictive powers. Nachman says, this is when people say, while women are speaking, they're also weaving, which is a statement, like we say, oh, women can multitask and men can't, it's that kind of thing, but suggesting here that she's talking, but while she's talking, she's also doing, so she's scheming, she's seeing something unfolding in the future, she's laying a seed in his mind, saying, farewell, maybe we'll meet again. She's like saying goodbye, but while thinking about something in the future. Igad Amri, some say that I've got a better aphorism for you. Shapel va'azel bar uvza, while the goose is walking, looking down, kind of bent over, Einom itfei, its eyes are looking up. I don't know if you've ever seen a goose walking. I'm sure we've all seen the pigeon, the way they walk. So a goose apparently walks with its head down, but its eyes are up. So it's saying that she's kind of saying farewell, maybe we'll meet again. So she's kind of suggesting she's bowing out, but she's thinking about the future. So again, suggesting prophecy, full stop. Let's do Cholda quickly. Cholda. Cholda literally means weasel, but it's the name of a prophetess. How do I know she's a prophetess? It says, etc. And there is unequivocal proof in that verse that she is a prophetess. How do I know? It says, Chilkiyahu the Kohen, Achikam and Achbor went. How does that prove she's a prophetess? I suggest at this point you look at the Pasuk first word line on the left bottom column. And they went to Chulda the prophetess. So that's the unequivocal proof. Chazal, or the redactor of this text, assumes we all know the pasuk, which says she's a prophetess. The Gemara says, well, hold on, she's around the same time as Yirmiyahu. Why are they all going to Chulda the prophetess instead of Yirmiyahu? He's the main guy. Because she was related to Yirmiyahu, so he didn't mind that she was going around and people went to her as well. Fine, I understand why Yirmiyahu wasn't upset, but why didn't they go to Yirmiyahu? He was the main guy. If you want the best treatment, you go to the best doctor. You don't just go to the doctor's second cousin because he's not going to be upset if they're not the specialist. Why are you going to her? Because women are merciful. Which again suggests that the prophet's got some capacity to change the message. Meaning, if prophecy is just a prediction's a prediction, who cares whether this person's merciful? It sounds like that there is some discretion on the part of the prophet here, and they want to go to the more merciful one. The second reason why they went to her, not just because she was merciful, Rabbi Yochanan suggests because Yirmiyahu wasn't around. He was busy on an important trip. He was bringing the 10 tribes back to Israel, who'd gone away. How do I know he brought them back? Quickly get through this. As it says, because there is a prediction moment when Yirmiyahu says the Yovel will be cancelled, which is an odd thing for him to say, considering Yovel had already been cancelled. The people had already been exiled. And then he says, out of nowhere, Yovel will go away. So it suggests it had come back for him to predict that it would go away again. Is it possible Yovel ended and then he can predict it ends again? It teaches that Yirmiyahu did bring the 10 tribes back. And we know Yoshio was a king on them. As it says, what is this signal that I see? Said Yoshio. Ashani Roer. Even the people of the city said, Hakeve, it is the burial ground. It's saying, oh, it's this person who predicts things in Beit El. And the Gemara says, what's Yeshua got to Beit El? That's in the northern kingdom. What's that going to do with Yeshua, who was the king down in Judah? It indicates Yirmiyahu had been brought the 10 tribes, Yeshua was king on them, and that's why he wasn't available during the period when they went to Chulda. Rav Nachman on Mehach, Rav Nachman said they've got another proof that he ruled over them. Gam Yehuda Shat Ketzilacha, B'shuvish with Ami. There's an indication there that Judah will have rain again over a special harvest in the return, which indicates that Chulda went to for that reason. Let's just finish this couple of lines. Esther, how do I know? Esther was a prophetess. It says, V'hibiyom Shashiv Dabashes Malkut. It says on the third day, and Esther wore royalty. Big day, Malkut. It should say that she wore royal clothing. What does it mean she wore royalty? Elish Shalavashta Ruach Kodesh. She put on divine spirit, tivhata, tilbash, tivhatam, ruach lavshed ami, and the association of ruach and donning, levisha, suggests that you can wear the divine spirit. We'll finish just this blue and then we'll wrap up. I'm sorry, went on a little bit. Let's just get this done. This is an odd reflection from Nachman after everything we've just said. There were 7 prophetesses. Would you say this is a lowercase b progressive duff so far or a conservative lowercase c duff so far? Yeah, progressive. 7 prophetesses. If I wanted to suggest that female rabbis, I just got a whole duff. We've got Devorah, we've got Hannah, we've got Miriam, we've got Sarah, we've got Chulda, we've got Esther. Second? Abigail, who saves the king from slaughter, from affairs. Women should be given a prominent role. So Rav Nachman, reflecting on this, tries to take all the kind of the air out of that in one direction at least. He says, Lo ya'e yehuruta lenashe. He says, prominence is unfitting for women. How do I know? Tarti Nashi Arinavi, because they were 2 prominent women, Vasani and Shmayu, and they had very bad names. What were their names? Chadashma Ziburta, one was called a bee, Vichadashma Kakushta, and one was called a weasel. And who am I talking about? Who are these 2, Rav Nachman? Devorah and Chulda. He says, so that should already indicate that prominence is not good. How do I know Ziburta? What happened to the bee? Ktiv by it says, with her Tishlak and Dikrala Barak, she said, tell Barak to come to me. She didn't go to him, which indicates a sense of entitlement. Send him to me instead of him. And really, a person in power should go to the people they need. That's the Ezra of Nachman. Karkushta, what about the weasel one? Meaning, Chuldik Divba Amran Leish, in the context of the king, it says, say to the person, fellow Amra Amri Lamelech, and say to the king. We'll get to Rav Nachman and other comments going forward, and I don't mean that to be the last word on this subject, but suggests that there is a complication of the dynamic unfolding here where obviously women should have power and there's a resistance within the duff to what that means. And of course, there were 7 prophetesses and only 2, he points out, seem to be problematic, and he points them their names. So we'll maybe push forward with this a little bit next time, but we're now at a stopping point, and we'll pick up next week. Please God at the bottom. Thank you for your patience, your indulgence, and I wish you all a wonderful week.